Welcome to the Reimagine podcast, where we explore the philosophy of photography. I'm Ewan Bell. Inclusive frame of mind is a technique I teach to people to improve their compositions as an antidote to that tendency to crop too tight. We often end up focusing too much on what we want out of the frame and not enough on what we want in the frame. You have to get off that track to get results, and embracing the idea of being more inclusive is the key ingredient. The composition problem is that we end up shooting everything too tight, and not only does it make it hard for us to get variety, it's hard for us to step out of that framework. Once you're on this, I've got to tighten up, I've got to get this out of my shot, you're always thinking about what you want to take out of the shot, and you're not thinking about what you want to bring into the shot. And that's the basic problem. It puts you on the wrong path.
Oh, I agree with that, Ewan. I think you sum that up quite nicely, and I think I suffer a little bit from that.
You shoot quite a lot of portraits, don't you?
I do shoot portraits, yes. I wouldn't say quite a lot, but I do shoot portraits, and I do like to do sort of conceptual type of portraits. And that tends to be, because it's in the studio environment, it tends to be a much tighter types of shots.
Is that because the scale of the scene you're working with is really constrained by the size of the studio?
Yes, it is. But having said that, I do like to do some of these sort of more conceptual ones where I like to bring in not just a person to take a portrait of, but to bring in a character and build a little story around that character. One that I did recently was of a fortune teller. So, you know, I'm trying to do a portrait, yes, but trying to also build a story around that with some of the background elements in it, in the very way that we're about to discuss.
Obviously, it's a fairly different situation if you're in a studio and you're trying to compose the scene. You're not just composing it, you're actually creating the scene, aren't you? Whereas the kind of work I do, I go out into the wild, whether that's a market or a place or a town or a city, and I'm trying to pull scenes out of the real world. And I have a lot less control over my subject in that process.
Yes, and I think that's where my lack of storytelling comes about, because I think you handle that really well, and just have to flick through your book, Reimagine, to see that. You create these stories through the subjects and the environment, whereas my storytelling is lacking because I tend to focus on that, trying to get it too tight.
I'm trying to give a sense of place. So if I'm shooting a portrait of someone, I want to know where they are. I want to know their context. I want to bring that sense of place into the scene. And you can't do that when you're working in the studio, because the studio is the place.
That's right. You are confined by that space, and more often than not, you're confined by the resources that you've got to try and create that. And that's why it takes me a long time to come up with concepts and to be able to build those elements into some of those conceptual type of portraits that I'm trying to do. Got to bring in props, and you've got to bring in things, and they don't always come together easily, so it takes a long time. Where in your photography and the things that I see that you're doing, yes, you are working really hard to bring that sense of the environment into those images.
Where you and I cross over, I think, in terms of the studio versus the wild, is going to be food photography. I do work in restaurants and wineries and travel context with food, but also do stuff in the studio. What we often talk about when we're trying to teach food photography is you don't want to just shoot the dish, you want to shoot the whole table. What we're saying is you've got to step back as much as possible, bring more in. It gives you room to compose. It's often hard to do in the studio because the scale you're working with is often constrained by physical constraints. You often set up your studio to shoot one dish, but you actually need the entire restaurant if you're going to get your best work. A lot lot of us learn to shoot too tight because we're trying to avoid things we don't want in the frame. And when you shoot too tight, it leaves no room for your compositions to get a little bit of variety and all your shots start to look the same.
Yeah, I agree, because for me personally, that's something that I've learned over time, because I'm in a camera club and I always get this feedback that says, don't waste space around that's not actually a part of the story. Whereas you were saying that quite often that space around your image is a part of the story. So there's this conflicting information that we get. You're a commercial photographer. I'm a camera club person.
Tell me more about this idea of don't waste space. Is this a kind of a less is more scenario?
It is less is more, particularly when we're talking about when we're photographing people. We don't want to waste their space. And one of the things I've learned from that is that if I don't waste the space when I take the photo, then I have actually got more pixels to work with when I'm actually processing the photo. So that gives me a lot more scope to be able to bring out the best in those images and those people, bring a lot of attention to the sharpness that I hopefully I've captured.
To me, that sounds crazy because your camera has got a bucket load of pixels. It's a really good camera. Do you think that this is a culture that came out of the transition from film to digital, where you had maybe an 8 or a 10 megapixel SLR, whereas now we have 20, 30, 50 megapixels is extremely common with an SLR? I think also one of the issues with, if we're going to compare film to digital, in the days of film, what we held up as a really good image doesn't look so good today. We see so much more with the digital sensor. We have a very different standard that we try to work to today. And I wonder whether people are just worrying way too much about those pixels and they're not thinking enough about the photograph.
I certainly think that that is something that has crept into my thinking for quite a while now. I do think about an end result, and sometimes it's about the actual pixels and that sharpness of images. You know, you look back at many of the old fashion photographs of the 60s and that period, and yeah, they're not as technical as we're demanding now, but they're still fantastic photos because the content is the important part. I think we are losing sight of the content sometimes over the technical. So in terms of environmental portraits, what do you call them then? Just portraits?
That's right. I call them portraits. It's like when you live in China, do you go out for Chinese food or do you just go out for food? It's like the environment's there. Like that's your shot, right?
Yeah. So, that's a really good point. Hang on.
Cropping. I nearly never crop. I don't like to crop my shots. It's not about trying to get it right in camera, but it's about changing my attitude to simply embrace bringing more into my scene and turning off that part of the brain that's telling you, get this out, take out the light pole, take out that Coke can and all that kind of stuff. I want to get off that train. That train leads you to the same composition every single time. Instead, I want to get on the train that says, well, let's just bring everything in and let's see what we have. And stop worrying about those things that you thought were a problem, because maybe they're not. Once you step into that wider frame of mind to think inclusively, you start getting options for your compositions. You start getting complexity. And that's what I want with my composition. I don't just want one subject taking up 3/4 of the frame. I want complexity and I want some room to move and to create something.
There's some really interesting words you use here, Ewan. Complexity is one of them. I want to go back to the start of what you just said there, and you want to bring in some elements like the light pole and those things that are there and not focus on that. In my world, as a part of Camera Club, oh, my God, every single time I hear about this, don't include this, don't include that. step this way, step that way to remove those elements. I could be at a camera club and listen to 100 critiques of images, and 90% of them will say something to that effect. What you're saying is include those environmental elements in it to make that story. And I think the point here is that we need to be able to look beyond the actual subject in the photograph and then look around the viewfinder to see those elements and then, yes, move until we finally, that image is that we actually want and that will actually be strong and tell a great story.
Now let's look more closely at the telephone pole scenario. If there's just this one pole and it's not part of your composition and it's not actually connecting to your subject, then I can see how that can be not great. But the goal isn't to try to get every single pole out. The goal is, okay, well, let's actually find something that shows the rest of the street. Let's have 10 poles instead of one pole. And now suddenly, instead of a pole that's crashing your party, you've got context, you've got a street, you've got a sense of place.
Question to you, Ewan, because I hear these comments from various people within Camera Club. How do you work those scenes to be able to stop including those things that are those complete distractions?
There are times when there are things you simply don't want inside your composition. That makes sense. But it's more about changing your perspective. If you're constantly trying to get things out, you simply end up with less than what you started. If you're constantly trying to think, what else can I bring into my shot? And those are literally the words I run through my head. I take a shot, I go, yeah, that's all right. But what else can I bring into my shot? And this sets you on a different path. And that's the key point. You got to get off the path that's not working for you.
I like what I'm hearing from you in terms of that, getting off that path and thinking in a different way. I want to go to Camera Club and say the very same thing that you've just said to those members. Then there's points involved. So all of a sudden there's this competition that we've got to feel like we've got to win. So we've got to remove those elements. But you're right. To create better photos, we've got to think differently.
One of the techniques I use, one of the tools that I use to make this composition more palatable is that I work with the shallow depth of field quite a lot. If your subject is being shot at F2 and your background is going really creamy and soft, you get kind of the best of both worlds. You get to bring in that context and a sense of place, but the elements have kind of like softened out a bit. They're not as harsh. They're not as contrasting. And there's a very big difference between something that's going to complement your subject and something that's going to contrast. You don't want to over contrast, but you do want to have something to complement. And so shallow depth of field is one way you can walk that line. And it takes skill and it takes practice, and especially with shallow depth of field, because if you miss the subject, the shot's useless. But as a tool for working more complex and more chaotic scenes, shallow depth of field is very powerful.
Certainly when you look through your book and you see a lot of the work in there, you see that shallow depth of field and how beautifully that works.
Generally, with a landscape scene, I'm going to be shooting at something like F8 because I want lots of depth of field. Generally, but not always. Sometimes I will do my landscape at something like F1.2 if I've got that available. And I will make that scene in the distance really sharp, and I'll make everything in the foreground really soft. Now I can start to bring things into the foreground. So I can bring in an extra layer. So like I can bring in some branches or some flowers that are right in the foreground and just turn creamy and soft. And so they're there, but they're kind of like paint daubs rather than actual flowers or actual parts of the subject. So you can take a portrait of a mountain and add in the layers. So the process for me is, if I'm standing by the roadside and I take that shot of the mountain and I think, okay, that's good. What other layers can I actually bring into this? And by standing next to a shrub or a tree or a flower, I've now brought that in. And I do that because I'm looking for something that's outside the frame. And this is where thinking differently, you can only do that if you're thinking, what else can I include? What else can I bring into it? If you're constantly thinking, what do I need to take out of this shot? You're never going to bring those extra elements in.
Hey folks, you've reached the shameless plug stage of the podcast. Please go along to ewanbell.com to have a look at my tours and the book, Reimagine. And also, you can check out what David's doing with his workshop called What They Won't Tell You in Camera Club. You can see that at beyourbest.photo.
I was just thinking of an example of where there's this element that I've been trying to do, creating extra layering, if you like, to an image, but where I got punished for it, if you like, for want of a better word. When I was in China, I took a lot of photos, and it was wonderful. And I resurrected a photo I took of some turtles that were in a little pond as I was walking around this giant Buddha monument in Leshan. I took this wonderful photo of three turtles sitting on a rock, and they had the most beautiful reflection. The shells of these turtles were just had so much color in them, the reds and the green. It was beautiful. And I recently put that photo into a competition. And for me, the balance in the image was the reflection as well as the turtle sitting on top of the rock. But I got punished for that image because I included the reflection. I should have turned it into a panno, according to the judge. For me, that reflection was a part of this whole story and that layering that you're talking about. So I like it, but as we talk about camera clubs, you get punished for it, which is, I think, really harsh at times.
Yeah, which is why I think anyone who's on this particular podcast should go back to episode one on why competitions suck, because it talks a little bit about how camera clubs can crush the creativity instead of enhancing it. I want to see the turtle photo now. You're going to have to send me a link.
All right. Jeez, another critic. I'll send you a link. I'll send it to you.
It's exactly what you needed is one more opinion.
Exactly.
So this idea of trying to step outside the frame to bring something more in, your turtles sounds like a really good example of one of the other techniques that I teach. I call it the step back technique, and it's something that happens a lot when people are trying to do still life especially, but also works with portraits. The idea is if your tendency is to be too tight, and let's say that you're in a market and you're taking some pictures of some fruit and you get right in there close with a 50mm lens and you fill the whole frame, and then my advice is take your normal tight shot and then just take like half a step back, or even just lean back just a little bit, and then take that shot again, and then you lean back more, and then you take again, and you keep doing this. You shoot and step back and shoot and step back. What's happening is you're changing your compositional options. Each time you step back, you've got more room to work with. And at some point you go, oh, okay, I don't just have the fruit, but I've got the other fruit behind it, and I can work that in, and now I can push this off to one side. And okay, now there's this, like, you know, the seller's hands come into play, and all these different elements start to come in every time you step back and shoot again. And what you're doing is you're changing your compositional options. It doesn't mean that the wider shot's going to be the best, but at least you're working through a range of options and you're practicing dealing with more variables.
Yeah, that's really good practice. I think there's an old saying, I think, in film they say, something like the close-up, the medium, and then the wide. And I think that's what you're saying, essentially, is you've got to practice all of those different things. Sometimes the wide, you know, in grand vista, we're not necessarily talking about, but, you know, wider than what you would have done when you shot the tighter apple. I think that's a really good ploy to practice whenever you go out photographing.
Let's let's talk about wider lenses. I don't shoot portraits with a 70 to 200 mil lens. I know there are people who do. I shoot portraits with either a 50 mil lens or even a 24 mil lens. I like to shoot wide. A wide lens makes it easier, obviously, to bring more of that scene in. And a lot of people, I think, are afraid to go wide because they feel it's harder to control. There's a lot more variables going on. They kind of tend to shy away from that. And really, they need to practice working with those more complex variables. And through that practice, they'll get more confident and they'll start getting a lot more options with their compositions. So it's a really big difference to shoot with a 24 mil lens than to shoot with a 100 mil lens. They're worlds apart.
Most definitely. I think the thing that scares so many people off shooting portraits with a wide angle lens is that distortion. That can be a problem for people. And sometimes, in some situations, it's not the most flattering lens. And we have to think about that. So how do you deal with that?
I feel that if you're trying to shoot portraits with a 16 mil lens, that's going to be a problem. Trying to get close enough. The closer you are to your subject, the more of the distortion you're going to get. I don't have this problem a whole lot with a 24 mil lens. It's just not that big of a problem. And a 24 mil lens is a really, really sweet zone where you can get a 24 mil 1.4, which is really shallow depth of field. And that combination of wide and shallow is beautiful. You can work portraits with a 24 mil lens with a great deal of confidence because you can actually get in close if you want to without completely destroying the perspective. And also, particularly with portraits, and it's something which I touch on with a number of chapters, but the idea of you need to be connected to your subject. So the 24 mil lens, you're quite close. And so the connection between you and your subject is really important. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about composition more than connection. And you just can't beat having a wide lens to pull in the whole scene and to pull in the rest of the story and that sense of place. The wider you go with your lenses, the more opportunity you have to compose. It's really simple.
Ewan, sometimes when we talk about wider images, a lot of people don't think about the 24 to 70 mil lens, for example, as a wide lens. Yes, it does have a wider end to it, but when we're talking about portraits and wider and those two words together, sometimes people think we're talking about a 16 mil or a 14 mil.
Right.
And trying to take portraits with those. So that can really put people off.
When you get to 24 mil, you've got a wide lens. When you get to 16 mil, you've got an ultra wide lens. And I really do see those as very different lenses and for very different purposes.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think for clarity's sake, a lot of people would think, you know, when you say wide, possibly talking about 14 mil, perhaps less. But you're right. That is the ultra wide end of the spectrum, if you like.
It's important to clarify what do we mean by wide, what do we mean by standard, what do we mean by telephoto. That's actually a really good point to make, and it's not necessarily obvious to everyone. Another thing that's important is simply getting out of the center of the frame. If you're shooting tight, your subject's essentially always in the center of the frame. You can't get them out of the center of the frame. And as you step back, you get room to compose. And then one of the next challenges is that because we shoot with autofocus systems and they tend to lean towards the center of the frame, we still end up with our subject smack bang in the middle of the frame, which is okay to have a subject there. But if you've got a series of images, you don't want every single subject to be in the center of the frame. By trying to think more inclusively about your compositions and trying to expand that composition, you now get an option to move things out of the center of the frame. And this makes a really big deal.
Really important, and it's a really important skill that you have in being able to use your composition and that moving away from that central focus area in initially getting close, capturing what you need and taking that step back, recomposing and reworking the focal point so that you create differences in your images. I think for me, sometimes I'd make a mistake of not doing that. And it can be quite telling at the end of a day when I look through my images and I can see that there's so many similarities to all of them. They might be different subjects, but there's so many similarities because I haven't worked the scene as well as I should have and gotten the most out of what I probably should have.
I think it's one of the things that I work for when I'm actually doing a shoot for a publication. I'm not just trying to tell everything in one image. I have 10 or 12 pages that I'm going to run the images across. So I want some that are tight, that just have textural feel. I want some close-up portraits. I want some step-back portraits. I want some landscapes. I want a whole bunch of diversity. And I want to present a lot of options to whoever's going to do the magazine spread. I want them to have options. So there's a dance there between the images which I collect, because I'm collecting all these pieces of a story, and then I hand them to someone else and they decide which pieces of the story they're going to actually tell. And I don't have any control over what comes out at the end, but I try to give them a whole bunch of pictures. And that's really different to what you're doing in a camera club context, where I think often you're being judged on one image. That's not a creative zone I want to be in.
That's very true. It is quite often one image, and trying to pull out one image from a location or from a trip of some sort can be really difficult. Trying to win a prize and still tell a story at the same time, it is problematic.
One thing I'd like to see a lot more of in camera clubs is to present a photo essay instead of a photo.
I recently had to judge a book competition. The club gave me, I think it was about 9 or 10 books that the members had printed, and that was a wonderful experience for me, because you could see the people who threw photos together from their collection. You could see those people who told stories, and you could see those books that were almost sort of a biography of their life. It was really interesting to see the differences in that. I felt that was a wonderful experience to be able to see those essays, how people put them together, if they chose to put text with them or not. That was a great experience for me, and I hope that I delivered a critique to all those people that they got something out. It was a great experience for me.
I think that sounds really, really good. I think that's a really good format to offer to do a book. Because it doesn't cost that much to do a book these days. You know, just to do a one-off print on demand is not as crazy as it used to be. And also the thing I like there is that there's a process of curation that's happening. We won't talk too much about curation, because that's actually one of the chapters we'll cover in one of the next podcasts. But I really like that idea of using the format of the book so that you're actually presenting a collection. I think you could also do a version where you basically have something like 20 shots to tell a story about a place. When you're shooting for a photo essay format, you do need a bit of variety. And again, the key to variety is it doesn't mean you've got to avoid your tight shots all the time, but you want something other than just everything being tight. And that's why having that inclusive frame of mind and to think, what else can I bring into my shots? It becomes a process and becomes a step, gives you a lot more to choose from when it comes time to actually curate that book or to create an exhibition or to curate a photo essay.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Ewan, I noticed when you're talking about composition and including various elements, but there's also that element of negative space. And sometimes people feel that negative space is nothing. Is it?
I think it's everything. I think if you get it right, there's a calmness and there's a comfort that comes from having this beautiful empty space where your thoughts can rest. And it's really something that is undervalued by a lot of photographers. Negative space comes really natural to the work I do, because when you're shooting for a publication, you need to leave room for copy and for the layout people to run some copy across the top of an image. So we often leave space for, you know, for headlines and for copy and for the masthead and all that kind of stuff. And that's where it kind of starts off. But I've found it goes a lot more deeper than that. It's much more than just I need to leave space. When you get it right, I think that you're leaving room for your audience to fill in later. The negative space should give you a sense of possibility. It should give you a sense of where your image is extending beyond the frame, which is a powerful thing to do. If you can get people thinking about what's not even in your frame. So if you have a couple who are basically talking to each other, and then one of them is looking out of frame towards something else, and your brain's thinking, oh, what's the rest of the story? I want to know more. And you're suddenly compelled, you're engaged. Negative space is not just about, I'm going to leave some space, I'm going to leave some room. It's about, there's a sense of possibility that extends this story.
Would you say, Ewan, that negative space can be a very powerful compositional tool?
It really is a wonderful way to think about composition. And again, it changes your attitude. It just puts you on a different path. And if you're finding that your compositions aren't taking you to where you want to be, anything that takes you off your current path is going to lead you to something new. And that's got to be worthwhile. A really big thank you to David for being with us today to talk about inclusive frames of mind. For more information about the book Reimagine, you can go to ewanbell.com. If you enjoyed this conversation, please give it the thumbs up and subscribe to automatically receive the next podcast in the series. Have a great day.